What we are trying to do is here now.
Okay, we did this for an arbitrary large value of t. I'm trying to get rid of those two u's. What I want to have is the vacuum expectation of this time ordered product. And so I'm just choosing values that I more or less know what to do with. So this choice makes that one be one. So that one just goes away. Now this one, that's not going to be one. But what happens is, from minus infinity to infinity, acting on the vacuum state, we argued that had to be the vacuum state up to some phase. So we told this easily I alpha times the vacuum state. This is evolving the distant past to the distant future where we're in some asymptotic region. So we expect the vacuum state to return to the vacuum state there. But there is an arbitrary phase, and we can, we can evaluate that phase because this operator is e to the minus I from minus infinity to infinity, hi of t prime, dt prime, etc. Time order. So when we look at the expectation value of that, all right, that's equal to the expectation value of u over that range, and we call that e to the I alpha times. The norm of the vacuum state, which is 1. So we pull out the phase, and that gives us an explicit expression for the phase. Then the other thing, this implies, if I take the dagger the other way, infinity minus that's going to be e to the minus I alpha times the 0 state. And it's actually this that lets me get rid of this u. So I'm just going to replace the two of these by e to the minus I alpha times vacuum.
Is that bottom line there? Is our definition of u?
Yeah, this is. Okay. That looks like me. Okay. So this gets rid of these two extra unitary operators. So the whole thing now becomes. Well, here's e to the I alpha, this thing. So e to the minus I alpha is just 1 over that thing, so I get this big fraction. So, time-ordered product of phi of x1 through phi of xn. And these are now interaction phis, right?
I hope.
Yeah, that was the goal last night, was to get these to be the interaction mixture phis. And then we have e to the minus I integral minus infinity to infinity h interaction of t prime dt prime. And the time ordering vacuum expectation divided by the same thing without the fields in there. So if there are no fields in there, the thing is nicely normalized to 1. And that is, what were we computing?
is this our whole answer? Or is this a piece of it?
Oh, then, back, a few pages back, equation 546, this particular expectation value is then integrated over all of the coordinates x1 through xn, and that integral is then equal to some normalization factors times our original transition amplitude. So this was the one thing that we needed to figure out how to compute, because these were plain phis here. So phi I and hi we know in principle. All right, they're in terms of the the interaction Hamiltonian, the phis are in terms of the free field. The interaction phis that you get from the free field from the free Hamiltonian. Let's see. Now, any questions on this? This is what we should have ended with last time. Yeah.
So that relationship means something.
All right. What we're computing is a transition amplitude. So what we set out to compute was the projection on some final state, the scattering matrix, and the initial state. So we start with some initial state with m particles. They come into a region where they interact, maybe a particle accelerator or something, they collide, and then they go flying off into some far future state where presumably there are also free particles. So, they're initially free and they scatter and then they're finally free. We're computing this, and this is proportional to that. There are some other factors. Let me show you that.
That is essentially the B, S, and A. So we've got a product of these factors. Here's that expectation value, that vacuum expectation value, and it's integrated over all the X's.
So, integrals we can do, factors we can fact, but to find the vacuum expectation values, there's still considerable simplification of this thing that we can do. And it comes by expanding these phis in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And then we do some rearrangements of things. In any given term, we're going to have a whole lot of terms because each of these is the sum of an A and an A dagger. So you expand all that out, and now if you can write it, rearrange each term, get all of the A daggers to the left and the A's to the right, and those are normal ordered terms, the vacuum expectation value of a normal ordered term is zero, because you've got all the A's on the right and they're going to hit that zero, or you've got all the A daggers on the left and then that dagger left on a zero is zero. So any normal ordered pieces of that rearrangement you get to throw away because they're not going to contribute. So all it takes to do the rearrangement is the Nicational commutator. So those commutators of A's and A daggers give functions. So if any term that ends up being just those functions, those commutators, that's what's going to survive. And it turns out that if we do that for just two fields, that commutator is the Feynman propagator. So that's the simplest element of a Feynman diagram. It's a straight line in the Feynman diagram. A straight line in the Feynman diagram is a particle going from here to there. Then what happens is you have some interaction and there are branchings and things and other particles that go from there to some other place. So the diagrams will get interesting only when we put in this thing. But But for today, what we want to do is look at, let's just take the simplest case for starters. Let's take two fields and no interaction Hamiltonian and see what happens with this kind of a time-ordered product. So,
what is that expression equal to? The one on the bottom, or
this is equal to that.
Okay, everything in
is
the
equal to this, yes.
Yeah. This is,
okay. So the whole line.
That's all one equation.
Okay.
You don't have to photograph the line.
Okay.
We can draw it in on our computer screen. Okay. You got this over here.
Yes, sir.
So let's just take a pair of fields. Actually, I had exactly what I wanted to do right here. What do we have? The time ordered product of phi of c1 and x1 with phi of c2 and x2. Okay, it's that. We want to compute the vacuum expectation value of something like this. So, we'll just bootstrap off what we had here before. So, there's the time ordered product, vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of two fields. Now, remember our solution for the field is integral d3t over 2 pi cubed, all this root 2et. And then we have an a dependent upon g, e to the minus I, dx. And we have an a dagger, g, e to the I, dx, like this. And what Nagieri does is write this as the phi plus the phi minus. And I'm not sure at this point whether he's just chosen absolutely idiotic notation, because everything about this is minus. It's a lowering operator with a minus sign. Everything about the minus is plus. Or if he's really savvy and he knows that by the time we sort this all out, you know, we're going to be glad there's a plus on that one and a minus on this one. I don't know which is the case here. So I'm not going to change this notation to be more intuitive here. That is the minus term, that is the plus term, and that's just a definition. So, the point is, phi plus depends on the annihilation operator, phi minus on the creation operator, a dagger, and phi plus, commutatively phi plus, even at different points, this is zero, and the phi minus at x commutes with phi minus at y, but we have a non-trivial commutator if we take phi plus with phi minus, write what that is. We've got this integral going along for the ride, not really doing anything at this point. And then we're going to have a commutator of the A with the A dagger. In general, this is going to be at two different points. Let me call them X and Y. I've called them X1 and X2. Let me change that notation, actually, now that you've all carefully written it down. So let's call this x0 and x, and y0 and y, so we don't have so many subscripts. So this will be x0 minus y0. That's the time component of the 4 vector. X0 and x, y0 and y. Sorry to do this. then opposite zero, y zero minus x zero. Minus zero y. So then this is going to be that's fine. E to the okay, the A comes in with this minus I T X and the A dagger is a function of Y, so it's gonna come in with a plus I T Y. Four dimensional dot product. So the commutator gives us something like that, and there are two integrals here. There are two momentum integrals.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, let's call this one Q. And now we have d3t, d3q, 2 pi to the 6, and root 2ep, 2eq, like that. And we know what that commutator is. Does anybody remember what it is? It's like 2 pi cubed times the delta, 3 of D minus Q. I think that's what it was. I'm guessing that seems right. So we can do that integral. Let's just carry it along down here. So making that replacement, I do the integral over Q, use the delta function, and I'm left with D3P 2 pi cubed. Looks like I get an overall 2EP down here, because EP will be equal to EQ. Then we use this, and the exponential becomes, we're setting T equal to Q, so the energies become equal. So we'll have minus I T with minus and I think that's just right. Okay, question? Okay. So now that's the commutator, and it turns out this thing is going to be a function we're interested in. Let me get the definition right here for sure. Nope, not yet. We'll get there. It's actually, we're going to have this commutator in both of these terms, and it's only when we combine them that gives the thing a name. So we'll find a function that is equal to this thing. So now, here's what we want to do. Expand out to pi plus and pi minus, and rearrange things so that we have a normal ordered piece and whatever's left over. There's a thing called Wick's theorem. I'm sure I proved it at some point and I forget how hard it is, but this is going to be the two-field example of Wick's theorem. Wick's theorem is a rearrangement theorem for a product of n fields. We're doing the two-field case of Wick's theorem here. You can do a proof of all of Wick's theorem by an inductive argument. You assume it's true for n fields, and you prove it for n plus one fields, stick in one more field, and then you have this fuss with all the rearrangements. And that's what we're doing. But let's do this in cases. So case one, this first theta function, we have x naught greater than y naught. So in that case, the time order is product of phi I of x and phi of y. It's just going to be phi of x, phi of y. In that order, because x is greater, x naught is greater than y naught. Then we expand this as phi plus phi minus. We expand this one as phi plus phi minus. We multiply them all out. So we have phi plus of x times phi plus of y. Then we have phi plus of x phi minus of y. Then we have phi minus of x phi plus of y. And finally, phi minus phi minus x phi minus y. Now, this is almost already normal order. What do we have to do to get this thing normal order? Right? Remember, phi plus depends on the annihilation operator. Normal ordering puts all of the annihilation
right
to the right. So, the only problematic one is this. Everything else, okay, this only has pluses, this only has minuses, no problem. Those can be used, you know, we can do anything we want with those. This is already normal ordered. This is the only one that's not. So I'm going to flip that, and then I've got the whole thing normal ordered. Phi plus of x, so this, with those two interchanged, is the normal ordered product of phi x and phi y. But in order to do that, we had to subtract this and add phi minus phi plus. So what we have to do is stick in a commutator of phi plus phi minus here. And now that's a true statement. And then we can do it in the other order, which looks just the same. I think the x and y get interchanged. Let's just do it. So, case two.
Oh, maybe before you go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was the bad apple out of the series of four terms, and why?
This one. Because everything with a plus on it is the annihilation operator term. And we need to get the annihilation operators to the right. So all daggers to the left, all undaggers to the right. And we're just going to do the same thing in the other case here. We have phi I of x, phi I of y. And the time order of those, in this case, I'm going to ladder it that so close there, is the other way around. Phi of y, phi of x, and that's phi plus of y, phi, or plus, phi minus of y, quantity times phi plus of x, plus phi minus of x, equals phi plus y, phi plus x, plus phi plus y, phi minus x, there's our funny one, then phi minus of y, phi plus of x, and finally phi minus of y, phi plus of x. And this time that one is our one, so we're going to get the normal word product of fields, phi of x, phi of y, or x, y, and x. Actually, I can write these in either order because we're going to reorder them normally anyway. So it doesn't matter which of these I put first. Two phi pluses commute So there's no problem there. The only things that don't commute are these middle ones, and the normal ordering tells me which way I have to write them. So it doesn't matter which order I write these inside the normal ordering. Colon.
Which is Trump, normal ordering or time ordering?
You gotta do them both. Let's see. Normal ordering or time ordering. So if we put a T on a colon or a colon
you're
on
saying,
a...
Yeah, you're saying why not is greater than X.
Yeah.
So if I time order it and normal order it...
Oh, I see.
Which one do I do first?
Which did you do last?
Which did I do last?
The one that wins is the one you do last.
Okay.
So there better be an order to your ordering. It won't make sense. What we are computing is the time ordered product.
Okay.
That's what we need for our expectation value. We're writing it in terms of a normal ordered product because we want vacuum expectation values of this, and the vacuum expectation value of that thing is zero. So then we have our commutator, which is phi plus of y commutator phi minus of x. So, you know, we've just rearranged the terms into some things that go away, and the commutator that gives us this thing.
If you have a commutator, won't you get 2 of one term? Or not necessarily.
Won't I get which?
Two of like the underlying term.
The commutator... let's see. What I'm doing here is I'm adding and subtracting a term. So I'm adding phi minus of x phi plus of y and subtracting phi minus of x phi plus of y. And then this and this and this and that one, the curly underlines are the normal ordered product of the field. The remaining two terms form a commutator. So let's say the double underlined term give us a commutator.
Okay.
So
better.
The factors are right. Good to check. Okay, any other questions for good then? So now what? Now we need this thing again. And let me write it one more time. Well, okay. Now, note the vacuum expectation value of a normal ordered product, either one, is zero. Okay. So, is that clear? This may have all dagger terms or all undagger terms or some dagger and some undagger. If it has undagger terms, those undagger terms act on the vacuum and give zero. Because a lowering operator on the vacuum gives zero. Definition of the vacuum. Okay. If we have some of each, then all the undaggered ones are to the right, and they still get zero over here. If we just have daggers, and a dagger acting to the left is the dual state of an a acting to the right, which is zero. So those are zero as well. So something that's all pluses in here, a daggers in here, is going to give zero because it acts on that. So every term in the normal ordered expression vanishes. On the other hand, if we have the commutator, the vacuum expectation of these commutators, let me just write this last one here. That commutator is a function. It's this function, whatever that function is. So, if I call this thing, let me just call this D plus of x and of x minus y. It's some function of x minus y. So this, let me go again, shifting. I'm trying to save room for a line at the bottom. Oh well, shouldn't have. This is just that function. the which way to go. That's A plus A minus to the plus minus. So this is a D plus of looks like Y minus X times the back mod of X, which is just a function. If I've got my order right. Yeah, I had X and Y here, so I'm interchanging Y minus X there. So we get a non-vanishing value for exactly the commutator term. In fact, if you have more fields, what you get an overall normal ordered term, and then you get some terms that are a few fields normal ordered and a few commutators, and then, you know, you'll get one term that's just all commutators. Well, that one that's all commutators is the only one that survives. Even, you know, the functions don't matter. Any normal ordered term is going to give a zero vacuum expectation. So this is going to really substantially reduce it. The general theorem for n fields is called Wick's theorem. And Wick showed that you can always take a product of n fields, and basically you write a term where, you know, every pair is reduced to a D, and everything else is normal ordered, and then reduced to a D. The formula is okay, so we'll write it down at some point. But it's just a generalization of this, where you end up with a product of these D's in the end as the only thing that survives. Pretty much has to be the case. So let's go back to our original expression for T and see what we've got. I'll leave this. So what we get is...
Got it.
Okay. I probably don't want to throw this away quite yet. So this time-ordered vacuum expectation value is going to be theta of x naught minus y naught. And then we have the time-ordered product. Okay, so x is greater than y, so it's case 1. We take the expectation value, and we get this commutator of phi plus of x with phi minus of y. And then we have theta of y naught minus x, that's case 2, x naught. And now we have the commutator of phi plus y with phi minus of x. Anybody following in the book? Did we get it right? I think we're okay here. Yeah, plus y minus x. Yeah, that's right. And plus x and minus one. Good. And then we can we pretty much define this to be D of x minus y. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's summed up. It's an integral of that thing over momentum space. You see, it looks an awful lot like a delta function. In fact, it's a four-dimensional Green function, then we'll prove that. We'll just a minute go to get it.
So are these step functions?
The thetas are step functions.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You can step. Everything else clear? So now what we want to do is evaluate this function D. D is the Feynman propagator. Right. So when we're doing Feynman rules, what's going to happen is every time a particle goes from here to there without interacting, we're going to stick in a D, whatever D happens to be. You know, well, in this case, whenever a scalar particle does. But we'll come up with propagators for fermions and other sort of photons. Each different kind of particle has its own particular propagator that is basically the Green function for the field equation. And so we start to sort of reconnect with
you know, solid earth. She's other, it's not manipulated. We're actually doing something that is related to the field equation. Well, the thing we've got here, these commutators are just integrals like that. This commutator is exactly the same. This is B plus. This one is the same thing with X and Y interchange, so we're going to have a minus sign there. And the theta function, but we can get the theta function and everything by making this a four-dimensional integral, which is when it starts to look like a green function. This is a bizarre way to do this problem. Okay, why don't we find the green function for the Klein-Gordon equation? And since there's an overall Dirac delta of energy conservation, we can do one integral, and we get this. Even with the theta functions, we get that whole thing. So let's just do that. So now I'm finishing out this section from the fact of it.
Okay.
You judge.
You sure
Okay. Any questions before I start that?
What did you put into these step functions in there? What was the purpose of that?
All right. This is a time ordering. Right. So we broke the time ordering into two cases. One where X is earlier, one where Y is earlier.
Okay.
So at the end, I'm going to try to leave this board and do the green function.
Okay.
Because, in the end, I want to compare and show that what I get for the green function for the Klein-Gordon equation is, in fact, exactly. And we'll have a nice four-dimensional expression for it. So, I think, we'll probably do a contour integral.
What would happen if x equals y?
X equals y? You probably get the same thing in both limits. So that it doesn't matter which order, then this is an equal time commutator. What should happen is you could put an equal sign on either one of those and take that single point into account. You're integrating, so it's probably a point of measure zero anyway, but let's see.
They were
doing now. Well, no, x equals y is a special point because this is very reminiscent to the delta function. So,
just one. You should have had an identity or something.
Let's see. What is that commutator? The commutator. The same integrand is one. The thing we're writing is a Dirac delta function, right? This thing is a four-dimensional Dirac delta function, or, well, this thing. And so it's very singular at that point, actually. You're on the light cone as the thing goes wild. So since these things only occur under integrals, right, you can integrate the Dirac delta function and it can't be singular. But, this thing becomes one and you just integrate over all momenta. There are probably lots of those. So, I'm not sure that E is enough to make anything converge. So it may very well diverge at that point. Let's set this up for the green function and see if it doesn't work out that way. So our authors. Observation at this point is, look, this expression with this integral here and the plus one there can be written as a four-dimensional integral with the contour integral and it gives the poles and stuff. We're gonna end up doing that backwards. So we'll get the contour integral as the solution, a way of finding the solution to the green function problem, and then we will
do one integral, what would be that we get? Okay, so we like to call something like box situated by each other, plus m
plus minus
n squared on phi is, I don't know how many 2 pi's we want here. We may want a 2 pi to the fourth, I'm not sure. But we want a four-dimensional delta function, right? of the green function. So this is going to depend on 2 sets of things. So x minus y. So that would be the equation for the green function. Let me just see if he writes it. No, just minus I. No, no 4 pi. Got it. That's a choice of normalization. We can put any factor in G that we want. So minus I, just multiply by minus I over, you know, powers of pi, and we can get that normalization for G. So let's take that as the equation we want to solve, because that's the one he ends up with.
And pi one.
What's that?
And then setting pi equal 1.
Yeah, I don't know why I is desirable here exactly. Alright, so let's go. So what we want to do is to write everything as a Fourier transform. So let's write G tilde of P and Q. I guess this is x derivative here. So we have a p, it will depend on the y. Just one might be enough. Yeah, we'll see. Well, let's just try this. So g tilde of p will transform x and see what happens. All right, so what we want is d for p over some normalization, 2 pi to the fourth, probably, and then e to the minus I p. Now we want an x integral, right? No, yeah, that's right, this is right, I, yeah. There we go. So there's our Fourier transform to give g of x, y. And so we want to substitute that into the equation. We can also write del 4 of x minus y as a four-dimensional integral in p. D4 of p over 2 pi to the fourth, just the pure exponential p x like this, minus y. Let's see, so let's assume we can write this as a function of x minus y. Then I can just put x minus y here, and this will be a function of x minus y. All right, then keep the metric, so that'll be okay. That's good. And certainly del 4 of x times 2 pi to the 4th is that Fourier transform of the pure wave. So I substitute these into the wave equation, and I'm clearly going to have d4p over 2 pi to the 4th. And then box is going to get just the x here, so I'm going to pull down minus ip squared. So the I squared gives me a minus sign, then I get the 4 vector p squared. The 4 vector p squared is e squared minus 3 vector p squared. And then we have here plus plus m squared times our exponential But then this has our exponential too. If I bring this to the other side, I have this plus I. So bring this to the other side. Write it as this integral. And we have this, and then u to the minus I, c, x minus y, equals. We have a g missing. G tilde, where's g tilde going here? G tilde. Okay? Run through that a little. Question. Everybody see what I did? No. Where did I lose it, Joe?
I think, let's see, pretty much on the first line.
The equation for green function. Okay, when I have a field equation, you know, suppose I was solving the Poisson equation with, you know, for Newtonian gravity. You know, that would be the potential of the mass density. Okay, clever way to solve this is to first solve, find a function g of symmetric in two variables, but I'll write it this way, such that I get a delta function in x minus y over here. Then I claim that phi is equal to the integral of that green function times rho of y d3y. And the proof is to apply del squared to phi, and del squared comes inside the integral, because this is an x derivative, but a y integral. So I can bring it inside, and I get del squared of g of x minus y. And that's the only x in here, that's a del x. Then we have rho of y, d3y. But we've chosen g so that that's a delta function, a Dirac delta. So this is del 3 of x minus y. Then we have rho of y, d3y. And that just gives us rho of x. So it's the solution to the equation. Del 2 is phi. So it's devilishly clever, because solving this equation, that zero sets at one point, which means that I'm solving the homogeneous equation for g everywhere except some boundary condition. So this is actually easy to solve. And once I've solved it for a given set of boundary conditions, I have solved the problem for any source. It's a really good trick. You maybe haven't seen it before. I don't know. When did people see this first?
Graduate E&M.
Okay. You should have sat in my E&M class.
I really should have.
You would have seen these guys. Okay, so that's how the green function thing works.
53.40.
53.40?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there are a few places that, you know, you do see them, but they're not. So all I'm doing here is I'm taking the Klein-Gordon equation, and in place of some arbitrary source for Klein-Gordon, I'm putting that delta function. And so this will solve box plus m squared phi equals any source j by doing this trick. So if I was just trying to solve the classical equation, I would do this. I would write this down.
What is the new g going to be?
The which one?
G tilde.
G tilde. This is just the Fourier transform.
Right. Okay.
So,
but you end up with the new function.
Yeah. So if I can find this one, then I can transform and find that one.
Okay.
So I'm going to Fourier transform the whole equation. I can write the delta function as just the completeness relation for the Fourier mode. And I can, and here I've written g in terms of some g tilde that we're trying to find. Now I substitute into the equation. Well, okay, I need box plus m squared on this stuff. And that gives me this stuff integrated with the exponential. So, the box just pulls down b squared minus c squared times an I squared. And the m squared just comes along for the ride, and I've got my g tilde in my exponential.
Let's see, where did the e squared minus c squared come from?
This is two derivatives, four-dimensional derivatives. So on x, so it's going to pull down ip, a four-vector ip twice.
Okay.
So d dx mu here is going to pull down minus ip mu. And I've got two of those for phi. So I'm going to get this times another one.
Minus five. Okay. So is it a Green's function or a Green's function?
Well,
kidding.
Yeah, right. Either both. I mean, Green's function is often called a Green's function. It's a Feynman propagator, not a Feynman's propagator. I suppose it probably depends on whether you're from Harvard or not. which sounds stuffier? it doesn't matter. I don't think anyone will be confused if you say either Green or Green function. As a point of grammar, I don't know. It's one of those things that's probably hotly disputed among the grammarians.
But we see also, what's the other thing called, like in classical mechanics, something like that with an apostrophe S in there as well. Hamilton's, we call it a Hamilton's principal function, right?
Oh, Hamilton's principal function.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it's used in Hamilton. The one that drives me nuts is Gauss's law. How many S's do you write?
None if you read it in German.
I'll leave that as homework. I looked it up. There are rules, but they're people have agreed to disagree on it. The convention allows either one. One might be slightly favored, by probably the person who wrote the article. it's not wrong to do either one. So this is an aside on how to do Green or Green function. And we've got now the Fourier transform of a thing in brackets. So are we okay with this equation? Any questions up to here? You all right with it, Jeff?
I'm going to have to look at it more.
Okay. But you saw where this came from. This is a Fourier mode integrated over all t with some normalization of something that depends on t. That's a Fourier transform of this thing. Fourier transforms are invertible. So if I invert it, the thing in brackets has to satisfy the equation, which has to be zero. So I can immediately write g tilde of x minus y is whatever solves this equation. Well, the thing that solves this equation is I over b squared minus c squared minus m squared. Like that. So there's g tilde, we found it. G tilde of, not x minus y, g tilde of b.
Oh.
So g of x minus y has to be, guess what, the Fourier transform of that. It should probably have had 2 pi squared. Let's see. It's a square root for each one, isn't it? I'm going to change it. I think I want squared here. But I could be wrong. Anybody know?
Maybe you can define your Fourier transform.
Yeah, but I'm doing an inverse one. So if I use the square root, I have the same one on each factor.
Yeah.
So here I'll have a 2 pi squared coming back. And so this will be, well, it's just that, right? D4P. And then one through pi. So I e to the minus I p x minus y over then let's see e squared system. E squared minus b squared minus m squared. And if we want to do a contour integral, the choice of contour. Can be dictated by adding a small displacement of the pole off axis, right? This denominator has poles on the real axis. And if we displace that by a small pure imaginary piece, it shifts the pole slightly off axis so we can just cleanly do contour integrals to evaluate the thing. We'll see that plus pi epsilon gives us the right boundary conditions. It'll give us the science that we have here. The choice of contour here is purely a matter of boundary conditions. So by putting plus I epsilon, I've dictated some boundary conditions, and I'm pretty sure I've dictated the right one. We can put minus I epsilon and see what happens, and you know, we get some funny science or something. But it would be an equally valid green function. It just it would be a green function that has some different asymptotic condition on it. So we can do this integral. What do we want to do? Let's do the E integral, the P0. P0 is E. Do that integral. And we should get nothing. So, we have good contour integral?
In a while.
Alright. So, this is an easy one. We want the residue theorem. Let's look at a complex plane. And probably you'll have to. So, this is the real part of E. So, we're integrating. Imaginary. So, the imaginary part of the energy. So, we're extending all of the variables to the complex. Well, really, just E. We're going to do it in the complex energy plane. And notice that this numerator is e to the minus I c t plus, t minus, x0 minus y0 plus I p dot something. Okay, so the thing you have to pay attention to is this. Because we want to integrate along the real axis. This factor has roots. Okay, so E, that denominator vanishes when E is plus or minus the square root of P squared plus m squared plus IE, I epsilon, minus I epsilon.
Minus.
Okay, I need more space. We better move to the other side here. These points, since epsilon is small, this is plus or minus the square root of p squared plus m squared. Minus. But I epsilon over that square root, something like that. There might be a half or something in there. But the point is there's a minus sign here. So we'll work it out carefully. But if we're looking at the positive root, the pole has been shifted off that way. If we look at the other root, it'll be over there. I think that's... That's what he's got for this. So the poles that I epsilon, you know, accounts for the distance below or above the axis. And the spine has pushed them that way instead of pushing them the other way. Okay, so now, with the integral we want is the integral along the whole E axis, real E axis. But the thing we can do is we can add a half circle either down here or up there to make it a closed contour. And the question is, how do we make sure that we don't get any contribution from that part? Well, we use this exponential and we push that off to infinity. So we're gonna make E very large. If E has a negative imaginary part, that'd be good. Because we have minus I times a minus imaginary part that's going to give an overall minus sign, and then the magnitude of E is large. So if E is the real part minus I times some positive imaginary part, then as that positive imaginary part becomes large, this exponent becomes large negative and converges.
What does it say? Plus?
That's impossible to read, isn't it? Right, so you can see it.
We're only doing one integral, right? We're doing the integral over E, and we're trying to get a three-dimensional integral from that four-dimensional integral.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
We need to do it twice, though, because depending on the sign of x naught minus y naught, it converges in the upper half plane or the lower half plane.
Okay.
And we're going to pull out a different pole. So we'll get two terms with theta functions, one at each of those poles. So let me do this a little more carefully so we can see what's happening. I can find a marker that works. Maybe now. Let's try that one for a while. It may end up blue here. Okay, so carefully again. Times 1 minus I epsilon over twice C squared plus M squared. This isn't terribly important because epsilon can be any arbitrary little thing. We're going to take the limit as epsilon goes to 0 in the end anyway, so the detailed coefficient here doesn't matter. But this shows us where the poles are. So, so we have two poles. When we have the top sign, then the bulk part of E is positive real, so we're out here somewhere. So this point is root T squared plus M squared, positive. And then we have a displacement in the negative I direction, so we come down here a bit, and the pole is right here. Call it E plus. Right? Displaced slightly below that axis. Then here, when we have a negative sign, this is minus root P squared plus M squared. And when we have a minus sign here, minus the minus is plus, so we have a positive imaginary bit, and it displaces it up here to what we might as well call E minus. Okay, so just clear about how we arrive at the position of the pole. Now, we need to close the contour, and the thing that matters, what we're going to do is integrate along the real axis, and then if we put a loop here at a very large radius that we're going to let go to infinity by the end of the thing. So we're enclosing this pole. The residue theorem says that the counterclockwise integral around a pole in the complex plane just gives the residue at that pole, which is if the integrand evaluated at the pole, except for the divergent term, the one over x divergent term you throw out, and everything else evaluated at that point is the residue. And a complex analysis course will be a lot of fun, and you'll see that proof. It's actually a pretty simple proof. You integrate around a little circle around the origin and just integrate ezi phi to get this 2 pi I out.
Times the
2 pi times the
times whatever the origin. And then you distort it. You distort that little loop and you prove all kinds of things. It's complex analysis. It's fun. But you can't do it all here. I'll just use the residue theorem. And let's see. The thing that happens is the integral G is dominated by that exponential right there because the magnitude of E is becoming big. So in the numerator we have a term either the minus I E X naught. Hi, come on in. Thank you.
Sit there for you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. You bet.
Okay, by that term. You know, everything else is just coming along for the ride. The denominator we know is blowing up here, but anywhere else, okay, E's getting big, so the denominator's fairly convergent. But we have to make sure that this thing, as we stretch this circle out, is going to zero. And so we have two cases. Case one, X naught greater than Y naught. Sound familiar? All right, then this factor is positive. The x0 minus y0 is positive. Then what does E have to be in order for this thing, right? Here, E, at a point out here, E is equal to some real part minus I times some positive imaginary part. So anywhere down here, just imagine inverse negative. That's the only sign. So notice what happens on that lower curve. We have minus I. We've got some real thing that is going over the whole range, but we also have minus I times a positive definite imaginary thing here, times a positive definite x naught minus y naught. And this is just a phase, no problem there. But then minus I squared gives e to the minus positive imaginary part positive x naught minus y naught. So that, this real part of the factor, the phase doesn't matter, this real part is going to tend to zero as we take this curve out towards infinity.
So the e to the minus p part, does that go to zero then?
It's irrelevant. It's we can bring it out of the e integral. It doesn't depend on e. So, yeah, that's just coming along for the ride.
So do we have, let's see. Never mind, okay.
Okay.
I think.
With a great question, where'd it go?
No, I'm just thinking about where the x and the y's are on this graph, or they're not on there.
This is only the complex e plane.
Right, okay.
So everything else is just a parameter for this integral.
Okay.
Now, there are four integrals here, but the d3t can be pulled out here, and anything that's just t and x and y dependent can be pulled out. So that factor doesn't depend on e, it's just some phase. But our result does depend on the sine of x naught minus y naught. And so when x naught is less than y naught, we have to do another contour, and it'll have to close in the upper half plane because we get an extra sine in that term. So we'll have to choose a plus sign here in order to make sure that it's convergent in the exponential part.
Do you have to do two loops anyway, because one pole is being left out as you're going along the...
Okay, so the residue theorem says you go around a loop.
Right.
The value is 2 pi I, right, for a counterclockwise loop, but we're going to do clockwise. So for our clockwise loop, the value of that closed contour integral is going to be minus 2 pi I times the residue of any poles inside the loop. So this one won't contribute.
Right.
Only this one will contribute to this integral.
Okay. Except another one for the other one, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So when we do the other beta function, the other ordering of the time, then we're going to have to close the upper half plane and we'll get this pole.
Okay.
And that will put the sign in the answer. Yeah,
one. Are we assuming that E is complex? Or
yes.
We have some...
Yes. We've extended E to the complex E plane. Analytic continuation, you know, as long as the function in here is any function we ever use, an analytic function, we can uniquely continue the variable to a complex variable. And what makes this useful is that as we push this contour out to infinity, the value of the integral along this part of the contour is zero because it's suppressed by this exponential, which is going very strongly to zero. So the bigger this contour is, the smaller the contribution from that. So the whole contribution as we go up to infinity here is from the integral along the real line, which is what we want. So as long as we add stuff that we know can only add zero, we're getting the integral we're after. Very beautiful math. The residue theorem is just this glorious thing. It's fun to use once you, you know, practice that a little bit. Okay, so we're going to do that, and what it says is for this time ordering, g of x minus y, well, how are we going to impose that time ordering? Well, let's use the theta function of x naught minus y naught. That's what tells us that x naught is greater than y. So for y naught greater than x, we'll need another term. And what we get, because we're going clockwise instead of counterclockwise, we need minus 2 pi I. my two pies probably won't work out here. We should have left it four. that has, you know, sort of a convention. So, you know, we could take the four back. Then we get the residue of the integrand all of that stuff at E phi. Right? Now the residue of this function at E plus of I e to the minus I e, it's not minus, why not e to the I e not. Plus I e dot x minus y over, okay, the denominator I can write as a product of e minus e plus times e minus e minus, because e plus e minus are when this thing is zero. So if I just square that out, that's the equation I get. That's the expression I get. So the residue, you find the residue at E plus. Okay, if I put E plus in for E, this one is the thing that's blowing up. That's the pole. The residue means you throw out the simple pole.
Oh,
you know,
right.
A 1 over x type pole, not 1 over x squared or x cubed, but, you know, this is a 1 over a simple pole. A linear infinity.
And evaluate it at that point.
And you evaluate the rest of it at E plus. So that residue is equal to, I e to the minus I e plus x naught minus y naught plus I e x minus y. That's our usual thing, right? E plus is just the energy evaluated at, you know, just momentum, right? Where did it go here? As epsilon goes to zero, E plus is going to be the positive root of E squared plus M squared. That's what the energy is in these three-dimensional integrals. And in the same limit, E minus is equal to minus that. And since the poles are on the real axis, after all, we take the epsilon goes to zero limit in the end. Nothing around is going to end up depending on that. Then that's defined by E plus minus E minus. Well, that's just twice E plus, because E minus is minus E plus. So that residue will then be I over 2 e plus. And then we have this exponential, e to the minus I t x minus y, where, with the understanding that this t has an energy that's evaluated on the solution. Right? The energy is given by the usual expression in terms of the momentum. So here, this t only depends on the three momentum. So that's the residue. We put that here. We had a 1 over 2 pi to the whole book fourth. So I'm going to leave that four. I don't know if you want that. This 2 pi is going to cancel one of those, and we'll have our 2 pi cubed. This minus I here is going to multiply that I and give us 1. That's probably why it was there in the first place. And look, we get our 2e in the denominator, and this is looking exactly like the thing we had before. So, may I erase here? Let's write that one out. So g of x minus is going to be equal to, a cleverly arranged 1 over 2 pi cubed. We have the integral b3t over point e from this. We have an exponential, and we have an integral, oh, we still have the integral b3t. So is that the whole thing? Was that the whole thing? Yeah, that's exactly it. Okay, and then we have theta x naught minus y. Then we have another term, presumably is going to, we're still going to have a d3t. Let's anticipate a little bit and leave stuff. We know we're going to have a theta of y naught minus x naught. An exponential and some other factors. There's more here. We have to do the other contour integral. So let's do the contour integral now where, right? So this is case two. So let's just go. X naught is less than y naught. So we have an overall theta of y naught minus x naught. And now we close our contour in the upper one-half complex E plane. Why? Because where were we looking at conversion? Here, we have this factor, but now x minus y is negative. X naught minus y naught is negative. So now we have a plus I, so E had better have a plus imaginary part here, which means that we're now going to close, this is case two, in the upper half plane to make sure that the imaginary part of all of that exponent is e to the minus something real and big. And now we are going properly counterclockwise. So we have the other term here, so the second term, let's say g, I guess I could call that g plus and g minus. Let me call this g minus of x minus y. The second term is theta of y naught minus x naught. And then we get plus 2 pi I, because we're going the right direction. And then we have the residue at of the stuff at E minus, because this upper contour encloses now this pole and only this pole. So we need the residue at E minus. And then G itself actually has some other factors here. We've got D3T over 2 pi to the 4. We'll have the E to the, well, it exists. That's all part of the residue, sorry. So I don't need to write that here. So we need to put in residue. So 2 pi I. We have d3t over 2 pi to the 4th coming along to the right. Then we have to evaluate this thing at E minus. Well, E minus, we pick up a minus sign on the energy. And let's be a little careful here. We want the residue of e to the minus I e x naught minus y naught minus becomes plus I dot x minus y. Yeah. And then the denominator, we again write as e minus e plus, and times e minus e minus. And now, we want to evaluate that at e minus. The pole is this one, so we strike the simple pole at e minus, and we evaluate the rest of the expression at e minus. And it comes out perfectly reasonable. The signs are a little funny, and we have to change our integration variable to make this look right. So, we're going to have integral d3t over 2 pi cubed. I lost the I in the numerator. There's an I here. So, this gives a minus 1 from the two I's. Then we have 1 over e minus e plus is minus twice e plus, right? Because e minus is minus e plus. None of it is that one, does it? So we're going to get 2 of those, and let's write it in terms of e plus, because that's our usual understanding of what substitution we do. And then we have the exponential e to the minus, but let's say, what is it here? I'm going to put e minus here, so that's going to be plus I e plus x naught minus y naught plus I t dot x minus y. And then I've got the 2 e. These two minus signs are fine. Then, let's check here. Dx minus 1. The sign on the energy we've changed the sign on this space, right? We're going to have the plus sign here. This is minus I et is the first term. Here we have plus I et. That's good. But the problem is, if I have plus et, I ought to have minus p dot x. So I have to let t be replaced by minus t. So a change of variable. The change of variable is only going to change this exponent. It doesn't change the energy because that depends on d squared. It doesn't change the volume element because at the same time we change this, we put the limits, and that all corrects itself. We're still integrating over all t, so nothing happens there. So that's going to change this sign. And now, with that change, we can go ahead and insert the solution. Now, let's see how to do this. So, finally, g of x minus is equal to d3t over 2 pi cubed times twice et. Quantity. Theta of x naught minus y naught e to the minus it x minus y, four dimensional dot. Plus, now everything works. It's theta of y naught minus x. And then we have the exponential e to the plus I t x minus. And so what we've shown is that the green function for the wave equation is, in fact, the vacuum expectation value of a product of two fields. Now, I want to identify the propagator. The Feynman propagator it is this thing, right? So this is the Feynman propagator. So all of this is equal to d of x minus y. So the Feynman propagator is the green function. But d tilde in momentum space is, so if we Fourier transform this thing, back up. Fourier transform g, there's the Fourier amplitude, so it's this factor, it's I over that root, over that energy thing. E squared minus p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon, and let me see if they're in 2pi, but I don't think they're it's just that. So, and we can write that as the four-dimensional t, t squared minus m squared plus im. That's the Feynman propagator in momentum space. So, either one, they're both the Feynman propagator. These are Fourier transforms. The Feynman diagram perturbation theory that we do is going to end up being in momentum space. So whenever we have to insert one of these propagators, we'll be inserting this momentum thing. We'll be inserting that thing. We had a bunch of poles like that already on the other side of the equation. They're going to cancel. So this will work out as a fairly tight thing. Jeff, you said you had to leave 4 minutes.
4 months ago.
Okay. So I'm happy to stay for questions and, you know, whatever discussion.
Is there some time when you do like a quarter and a quarter of the complex plane?
There is an example like that. What you can do is, you know, if you square it, you know, squaring is a conformal transformation,
right.
And then it takes that wedge and it flattens it.
Okay.
And now you're in a half plane.
Okay.
So there are all of these analytic transformations. Any analytic transformation is locally conformal in a complex plane. So you can do any of those transformations, and it won't change your contour integral, but it's just a change of variable, and you can change back after you do it all.
Okay.
So those transformations are a fun way to evaluate things, because you're mapping the plane around in all these ways, and you can, you know, extend any point to infinity and any other point to the origin, and
okay.
I'll have to remind myself. It's kind of neat.
All right.
See you. Yes, see you. Have a good weekend. What else? Questions?
Did we solve the integral?
One integral, right? This expression for g up here only has three integrals left. We did one of them. We did the e integral, so p zero. So yes, we did an integral. Yeah, if you do an actual scattering problem, you may end up having to do the other three too. What you doing this weekend?
I'm not sure yet, so we'll see.
What a nice good skin.
Yeah.
Question, Jim?
Nice.
Everybody can read.
I have a question.
No, there's no question.